this public repudiation and humiliation of John Lee, who had been articulating that objective publicly and strongly.
Do you know why he was fired? Why do you think he was fired?
Well, insubordination, for one thing.
Really? As far as the central office
is concerned. As far as the central office is concerned. No, are you going to tell me why you...
No, I'm listening. I'm not saying.
How did it look to you
and the people there?
Well, it looked to me as though he was fired because there were forces in SUNY Central that were really opposed to the idea of the development of a full-scale university, the objective that he was articulating, and he was articulating it in consonance with the Healy Report,
sure,
of course. So it looked to me as though it was a combination of that opposition, which could have been channeled, whose origin could have been the private university lobby in the state of New York, but it was also, a kind of personal support of Lloyd Olson, I felt, that was, he had backers in Albany that we knew not of, one of whom was Larry Murray, I think. Am I wrong about that?
That I don't know. That I don't
remember that particular point.
The actual firing came after John Lee decided to go on the offensive when the opposition was gathering force against him. And he decided, he held a press conference and leveled certain specific allegations against SUNY Central, really. The SUNY Central was not living up to its public commitments, and the slow pace of development of the engineering college was one, and he cited a litany of things that were inconsistent between what SUNY Central was doing and what public policy appeared to be. And so he was fired very, very publicly. And I felt that was at least the public part of it, was a reaction to his counterattack.
But the whole case brought attention focused on Stony Brook and what the state was going to do about Stony Brook.
That's right.
It was in the New York Times.
Yeah, what happened, I was going to say, how did the chemistry department and PhD program get approved? There was this steady stream of articles in mostly in Newsday. The Newsday was very biased against, I felt that there must have been a Hofstra College lobby at work on Newsday, because there was a poisonous kind of thing that was going on. The kind of things that were being written in Newsday about the situation at Oyster Bay.
Yeah.
And trying to make it, the objective seemed to make it look like such a rat's nest that it was possible to solve. You might as well abandon it and give up and go somewhere else. It, along about December, so the John Lee firing took place in October. I was in South America when it happened, by the way. The John Lee firing took place in October, and along about December, Fred Heckinger, who was then the education editor of the New York Times, started trying to put together a background piece about all this. And in the course of doing that, he called me. And so I'm home, and the phone rings, and this is Francis Bonner. Yes, this is Fred Heckinger. And just wanted to have a little background discussion about it. And I spoke very candidly and very freely with him. And in the course of the conversation, I said that the only way we're going to... we're facing a situation in which we have to know whether we're going to be a graduate research institution or not, and it's very, really quite urgent, because if we're going to continue along that route, we have to get our PhD programs in place and recruitment of graduate student recruitment beginning this winter in order to bring in our first students in the fall. And that's the way we're only going to end up. That's the crucial issue. And he said, may I quote you? May I attribute that comment to you? And I thought about it and said, yes. And so buried in the Christmas time, New York Times, Sunday Times, page 147, is this long piece by Fred Heckenscher, analyzing the problems of Oyster Bay and the question marks that are hanging over, and it included this quotation from me, attributed to me.
Do you have a copy of this?
I probably do, yeah.
We ought to have that in the archive.
That's true. I'll try to find it, see if I can. And it was after that article appeared in the New York Times that Tom Hamilton came to Oyster Bay and met with the faculty and said kind words about the PhD program in chemistry. And next thing we knew, the chemistry and physics PhD programs were approved. We got our brochures out. We started recruiting for the fall of 62. So that was an interesting...
Yeah. Well, you had to call a spade a spade.
Yeah.
Well, by that time, Rockefeller was governor.
And by that time, well, he certainly was, yeah. He was governor. I think he must have been elected in 59 and took office in 60. I think that was the Rockefeller situation. So that was the message that told us that the mission, the direction that we thought the institution was going to develop was still in place, in sound. There's one other thing that happened, and I don't know how I ever got such chutzpah, but after John Lee was... After John Lee was fired, my morale was... couldn't have been lower, and I felt great responsibility for all these good people that I had recruited into this situation, which was going, well, it would just fall apart, and I didn't know where to turn for advice. And at one point, I picked up the telephone and see if I could speak to Commissioner James Allen, Commissioner of Education, the state of New York. And
did you know him?
No, I had never met him. I knew, however, that he had been on the campus. And, well, actually, it's conceivable I met him, but when he was on campus. I can't recall, actually, but if I had met him, it was just very peripheral. I placed a call and got through to his secretary, told her who I was, and... she got off the phone for a few minutes and came back and asked when I would like to come. I was invited to come up and visit the commission. And so I thought this was a great gesture on his part and a great opportunity for the campus, for me and the campus. And at the last minute I asked Arnie Feingold if he would just drive right up with me. We're going to drive up to Albany, and he did. And then when I got into the commissioner's office, I told him that I had his colleague, and he was quickly invited in. So Arnie and I together spent probably an hour with Commissioner Allen, and to tell him what we thought, tell him how the situation felt and where we were. Arnie had
this was in November, December of 61?
I'd say it was November.
November of 61.
I'd say it was November of 61. I'm quite sure it was before that article, that Fred Heckenscher article appeared in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And
what kind of questions did Allen ask you?
He didn't really probe. I told him on the telephone that we had what I thought was a situation of some desperation, that we had many good people and the potential, the nucleus of of an excellent institution, but that in the existing atmosphere of uncertainty and tension and polarization, that it was unlikely to hold together very long, and I'd like to seek his advice about it. And so when that was how I set up the framework for the discussion, and he just invited us to talk about what we felt. And I said, we want you to know how it feels inside that institution. We spoke very candidly. Arnie Feingold had been dean of the graduate school very, very briefly. That's another story. I'll tell you in a minute. He'd been dean of the graduate school very briefly, and the course of being dean of the graduate school, he had been in Albany quite a number of times with John Lee and had witnessed some of the battles that John Lee had been fighting directly in the SUNY Central. So he had more information than I did from that point of view, that part of it. And is that running out?
No, we still have.
That's quite a tape recorder.
Yeah.
So he listened to us, asked us some questions, and he advised us to hang in, you know, and told us a little bit about politics, about the politics of the situation, and he commented particularly about. Who was the chairman of the Board of Trustees at that time?
Frank Moore.
Frank Moore. He commented particularly about Frank Moore. He said that Frank Moore is so political that whenever any decision of this kind comes along, once you try to get into it, you find that Frank Moore has touched base with everybody, every political figure up and down the state, and you're boxed in. So he gave us a clear impression that he had deep interest in solving this problem and wanted this nucleus of excellence that we were describing to him, that we felt really, this nucleus of potential that we felt existed down here. He wanted it preserved. Mm-hmm. So he wanted us to know that he was active in the situation and at political level, political as well as intellectual level. And I think it was fairly clear that he had the ear of the governor. So there was a lot of reassurance for us in that.
Did he bring in at all the regents, the position of the regents? Didn't they have a position, or was he speaking for the regents?
I'd say he was really speaking for the regents. Mm-hmm. He was a very respected, highly regarded, very judicious, careful, but imaginative and skillful commissioner. Mm-hmm. He really was a first-class commissioner, and I think we owe a lot to him. I think that behind the scenes, my guess is that James Allen had an awful lot to do with straightening out this situation, and the fact that he did have the ear of the governor was very important. But as you know, the governor effectively apologized to John Lee for what had happened to him, and took care of him, to Rockefeller Brothers Fund.
Yeah.
The situation of Arnie Feingold being dean of the graduate school was an interesting one, because John Lee decided to make some appointments, some administrative appointments, at a time when he was when his relationship with SUNY Central was very shaky. Along about, I don't know, March, no, probably April, I think. Maybe later than that, maybe even May.
Mm-hmm. 61.
He decided to move swiftly and make some appointments, and he asked Sidney Gelber to be dean of the College of Arts and Science, and he was very concerned about getting a graduate school organization started, because this was the key to consolidation of the mission of the university. So he wanted formal recognition, even if there were no graduate programs, but it was planned to build graduate programs quickly. So he wanted to establish a graduate school as a
infrastructure.
As a graduate school infrastructure right away. And after, I can't forget whether it was after or simultaneous, he asked me whether he could appoint me the first dean of the graduate school. And I gave him my consent. I was willing to serve. And he took the appointments to, I forget whether it, that went up at the same time as the appointment of Sidney Galbraith. I have a feeling it may have come up at a different time. But anyway, we proposed Sidney Galbraith's appointment, and that was approved, and Sidney then became Dean of Arts and Science. And then at a later time, he requested approval of my appointment as Dean of the Graduate School, and it was refused. It wasn't refused in a very direct way. It said that they came back with a statement that they would approve the appointment of Leonard Eisenberg. And that was interesting because Leonard and I were friends when he came and have continued to be friends, and we were friends throughout that whole crisis. But he saw things differently, and he saw the turmoil and conflict in a somewhat different way. And he, when things became very polarized, and it became whether you support John Lee or you support Leonard Olson, is what it came down to. Leonard was supporting Leonard Olson for reasons best known to himself. And so that was interesting. They didn't comment on me, they just said they would approve the appointment of Leonard Olson.
Well, was
and Leonard Eisenberg.
Was Leonard Eisenberg appointed? Or how did Arne Feininger get?
That was not accepted by John Lee. That proposal.
I see.
And so I backed out of the picture. I mean, I didn't try to get John to insist on appointing me. It's fine with me. And I guess Sidney and I came up with the idea of appointing Arne, and that was brought to Albany, and they approved it. And so Arne was the first dean of the graduate school. And then he resigned in a very... When Tom Hamilton came down after the massacre, the firing of John Lee, Tom Hamilton got Sidney Galbraith in his office and suggested to him that it would be appropriate if he were to step down. And Sidney graciously stepped down. I mean, he was effectively fired from the deanship. And Tom Hamilton then got Arne Feingold in his office and asked him to continue as dean of the graduate school. And in the course of that conversation, Arne learned that Tom had asked Sidney to step aside. And Arne was very irate that he would take such an action without consulting the dean of the graduate school, and very loudly and vocally and angrily resigned. I think that shook up Tom Hamilton quite a bit. And then I guess we didn't have a dean of the graduate school until Dave Fox was appointed.
We didn't have a dean of the graduate school. I was there when I first came.
There was none?
No. That line was vacant.
Was that after David served? It was just vacant.
I think it was vacant.
Because, as I understand it, we looked at John Tull first as dean of the graduate school. I was concerned.
That's true.
I was concerned that we did not have a dean of the graduate school and were supposed to go into graduate work. And I felt that the dean of the graduate school should be appointed and have a say in what was going on. But we needed a leader at that level right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And
well, you came in 62, right?
Right, September 62.
September 62, which is just after we moved out here. So I guess that's right. Ernie Feingold resigned.
Yeah.
And that position was never filled.
Right.
So then you asked Dave Fox to do it.
I don't remember. Frankly, I think probably that was vacant until John Tull came.
Really?
I
doubt that. I mean, we had a graduate school going. By
yes, I know you did.
September 62,
You had a chairman of a graduate committee.
Yeah.
And I think that was Dave Fox.
Uh-huh.
But I'll ask Dave Fox. He will probably remember better than I.
Yeah.
What I did about it.
Yeah, you should.
You see, one of the difficulties that I was under was that. I never knew from one moment to the next when I would be going back to Albany.
Yes.
See, I had been appointed in the Albany office as executive dean there and was immediately on detail to Stony Brook. That was there he was. I was go back as soon as they found the president. And I didn't feel that I could make very many moves, or should make many moves, as a kind of interim fill-in until somebody full-time was appointed there.
And you inherited the worst of the polarization. I mean, you had to deal with a very ugly situation in the mathematics department.
Right.
The concerted campaign of Spike Martin to get Les Peck. That was unfortunate.
Yeah.
That was really very unfortunate. It was, and I was blamed by those mathematicians for the Les Peck appointment. Because, and the way that happened was that Sidney, as dean of Arts and Science,
just watch that light.
Okay. As dean of Arts and Science, Sidney was looking, you know, in the short time that he was in office, he was looking for someone. He was looking to solve the mathematics department problem, which was a very severe problem. I mean, there's no question about that. And he wanted a consultant, and he spoke to me about it, and I had worked at Arthur D. Little. I'd done some work that had involved some very sophisticated mathematics and had been helped by Les Peck, who was an employee of Arthur D. Little. So I was very impressed with him, as a mathematician, the work that he had done with me, and I suggested his name as a consultant, and Sidney brought him in as a consultant, and then Sidney, I think, acted a little too hastily because he offered him a job in a rather hasty manner, and so it was the way the appointment was made, and then Les Peck had an Achilles heel or two that made him vulnerable, and that was a very bad situation. I was very, very sorry about it.
Well, he was gone when I came.
And
Harry Porter handled that.
Yeah, Harry.
Harry Porter got him to resign. They forced it.
Well, Harry, I thought Harry was doing a good job. He and I got along very well. Two historians. And Harry was kind of amused, would talk to me in a kind of a bemused way about various individuals and the situation there.
Yes. He tended to be a little too detached, I'm afraid. That's the way I feel. I have to tell you an amusing story about Harry. Of course, we all got, especially the department chair, we got to know Harry very well. And in the summer of 62, just before you came, we're getting ready to move into these new buildings, and there's a capital equipment budget that goes along with them. So we had to draw up a capital equipment request in the chemistry department, and so I got my colleagues all together, and we worked on this very hard. We drew up specifications, and we included nuclear magnetic resonance equipment and a very broad range of spectroscopic equipment, and in general wanted to get started with as excellent a research facility as we could. And when we added it all up and put it together, the bill for equipping that building came to $1.25 million. And this was DPW construction. $1.25 million had never been anything in SUNY of that magnitude. And Harry Porter was extremely dubious about it. But the day came when it had to be defended. The request had to be defended to the
Bureau of the Budget.
The Bureau of the Budget. So I was asked to come up. I flew to Albany. Harry Porter met me at the airport. It's kind of amazing to think about that, isn't it? So Harry Porter met me at the airport. Personally, very, it was very nice of him. And we went someplace and had a cup of coffee and a muffin. Is it still operating?
Yeah, still going.
And he, in the course of, before the appointment, which I think was 11 a.m., Harry Porter was quite clearly trying to make it, preparing me for a letdown. I shouldn't get my hopes too high that we're going to get anything like that $1.25 million. And he told me about this terrible budget examiner that we have to deal with. He says, if it's so-and-so Roberts, says, forget it, it's going to be terrible. So we go to the state capitol building. So the hearing is me and Harry Porter, and this guy comes in and it is Roberts. So we start talking about the equipment, and Harry Porter starts making some comments about, well, we could really cut this or we could really cut that. And Roberts cut him off and said, I've dealt with Dr. Bonner before. I have great respect for him. I went to accept his opinion. And we went through this budget hearing and then went back to Thurlow Terrace and sat there with Milton Lewis. Remember Milton Lewis?
Yeah, vaguely.
So I sat there, and then about an hour after lunch, Milton Lewis got a telephone call, and the entire request had been approved. Had been eliminated. And Harry Porter was absolutely flabbergasted. They were both very pleased. But I think Harry was really trying to do his best to support it, but his way of supporting it was to show willingness to be flexible and compromise. And it was interesting that this guy just stopped that, said, well, we want to do this right, and they approved the whole thing. And Milton Lewis said that there'd never been anything of that magnitude approved in SUNY before that day. It seems like peanuts now, but it was a great day in our department.
The Bureau of the Budget, the division of the budget right now,
is the right arm of the governor.
Yes.
And Rockefeller was governor. And he may have gotten,
Roberts may have gotten his signals
clearly from the governor.
Could be.
Get on with the job of building the institution.
It may have gone back to the Fred Hackinger piece in the New York Times. Who knows?
Yeah.